alley. We haven't done yet. I think we did the other ones up. So you're in a bowling alley, you're Fillmore scene, and go ahead and go.
I've been searching for the man who stole my bowling ball 15 years ago. I tracked him to this small bowling alley in the middle of Wildo, Wisconsin. I was about to get lucky. Hey, nice style.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This face looks familiar. I didn't know if it was from my past or from some dog food can I'd kicked around in an alleyway. I decided to play it cool.
You're playing it cool?
It's the way I always play it, stranger.
There was something about him that just turned my stomach. He was good looking like I had an afro. I decided to confront him. Hey, you. I know you took my bowling ball 15 years ago. I want it now.
I don't know what you're talking about. I knew what he was talking about. But I played by the rules and he didn't. You see, every time he comes forward to talk, he steps over the line.
Welcome to Make Me Watch. We are a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, whose gangster name, based on a physical defect, would definitely be Tits McGee. What's going on?
Oh, cold-blooded. Cold-blooded. You could do better than that.
I didn't really have it. Yeah, I was trying to. I was like, but you know what? McGee's always so fun to say. And I think the origins of me calling you McGee instead of Sean are always based on that that Anchorman Tits McGee. He says to Christina Applegate. You have the perfect last name for nicknames. So that was a throwback to the origin of it.
Boo. No, it's acceptable. I'll allow it.
How are we doing, brother?
I'm doing not bad after a little audible, but you know, we're getting there.
This is the show where Sean and I trade off forcing one another to watch our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening wherever you happen to be listening from. You could be doing anything else with your time. We're happy you're here with us. And follow our socials in the show notes. While scrolling down there, please rate, review, and give us 5 stars and support your local artists, us, the podcast. Thanks, please. And join us on Patreon for exclusive shows. We have some interesting stuff over there. I'm going to toss it to McGee to give his recommendation of the week, brother. What do you think people should be pairing with this one?
I mean, we had some noir picks in the past, but we've also talked a little Fletch early in the life of the pod. And I think is right there, right in that like late 80s. We're kind of diving deep into the like pulp novel adventurer series for our movies here. So it's interesting to see the way that this genre had its hold on the pop culture in this time period. So go back and check out Fletch, which if I remember, Eric loved.
Yeah, that was a favorite. And on today's episode,
Chevy Chase, huge fan.
On today's episode, we have McGee's pick for the week. It's a 1990s Dick Tracy. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling and dive into the film with our world-famous segment that breaks down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind-the-scenes stories. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 1990s Dick Tracy.
Let's go! Big Boy Caprice, Breathless Mahoney, Flat Top, the DA, Prune Face, Mumbles, Lips Manless, and the Blank are out to get the greatest detective of all time.
I'm rubbing him out.
I want him dead!
Nobody touches Tracy but me.
Tracy!
Tracy.
Tracy?
You mind if I call you Dick?
I was beginning to wonder what a girl had to do to get arrested.
Wearing that dress is a step in the right direction.
For a tough guy, you do a lot of pansy things.
Tracy battles
move! Everywhere I turn, it's Tracy! Tracy! Tracy!
You're under arrest.
Aren't you gonna frisk me?
Hey, copper, maybe you want to look before you leap.
When it's time to fight crime, he's your man. Walt Disney Pictures presents Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy.
Whose side are you on?
And Madonna as Breathless Mahoney.
Are you gonna make a move? Do I have to do everything?
I'm on duty.
Dick Tracy.
I'm on my way.
All right, so that was from the trailer of 1990's Dick Tracy. Here's a log line. Legendary police detective Dick Tracy is the only man tough enough to take on gangster boss Big Boy Caprice and his band of menacing gangsters. This is This is directed by Warren Beatty, photographed by Vittorio Storaro. I believe that's how you pronounce his last name, but legendary cinematographer Vittorio. Written by Jim Cash and Jack Epps, based on characters by Chester Gould. Starring Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy, Al Pacino as Big Boy Caprice, Glenn Hadley as Tess Trueheart, and Madonna as Breathless Mahoney. We're going to start it up top in our exit interview section. This is how we begin every episode and our general takes on the film, spoiler free. Asking McGee right up top, why did you make us watch this?
I mean, I think for obvious reasons, this was one that I expected to have slipped past your radar. It definitely seems like it is both like right up your alley, but also something that I wouldn't be surprised if you had missed. But between the like obvious level of talent in front of and behind the lens, the like pulpy campiness of it for sure, I think may have been turned off like general audiences, but I was excited to dive back into this one. This is one I mentioned, you know, when we were talking about the preview last week, that it's not something that I go back and revisit. I probably haven't seen it since I was young, but this is something that like I remember having the toy, like spin-off toys of. So the movie itself, there are moments that watching it now definitely surprised me. Do not remember there being a straight up nipples in this. Was probably out of the TV edit that I had seen, when I was three or four or five, whatever. But the movie at large though, I think is just such a window into the time, like I was mentioning earlier, of like when we were going to these, you know, it's so strange because this came out so soon after Batman that you would think this was made almost entirely in response to the success of the like Tim Burton Batman. But this was like in production while that movie was coming out. So this isn't as reactionary as it might seem at first glance. Like this is just kind of where the moment in pop culture that where we were going to for our stories. We were scared of crime in the 80s and needed a square-jawed dude to set things right outside the law with our Batmans and our Dick Tracys and our anti-heroes at large. So it's a fun little like window into pop culture, but also like it's in another interesting like watching this now in the era that we are with Marvel movies and comic book movies at large, where it's not so surprising to we've had Robert Redford in a Captain America movie and Harrison Ford in a Captain America movie. Like we've got these like old elder statesman actors to do roles like this pretty regularly now, where this was kind of the OG, like watching Pacino and Hoffman and everybody putting on a bunch of silly prosthetics and swinging for the fences. Was something that I think was more novel in this movie and somehow pulls it, I don't know. I think it seemed more strange in this context than if this movie came out in 2025. But I mean, ultimately, I think this movie's a lot of fun. It's a blast. People are having a blast. Like, Pacino is not just phoning in this performance at all. Yeah. He's giving committed. It.
Yeah.
He's committed. We got Madonna, like icon that she is, just again swinging for the fences for minimum wage. Like she's making SAG scale on this movie.
Yeah, I saw
like
that.
the
Who
level
would
of like
fight so hard to be a part of it. You know what I mean? It didn't
right?
seem. It seems like a natural pairing. I don't know why you would. Seems like if she's interested in the part, you kind of want to do everything you can to
right?
get involved.
It is like it's not. This isn't like this is like some like young guy like that nobody's heard of. Like this is peak. You know, 1990 right. Madonna. So yeah, it seems so wild, but. Just everybody actually
maybe
being
she's
committed
unproven at that point.
It,
I don't know. If this
oh
is
yeah,
her first
for sure.
role. I couldn't.
It's. I don't think it's her first like acting role for sure. I think she's been in a couple things before, but it was nothing that was taken super seriously before, if I'm not mistaken.
I mean, Warren
yeah,
was just, born in the late 30s, so maybe just Madonna missed
yeah.
him. Like, he wasn't sure what the kids were listening to at this point.
But yeah, I mean, I just think it was a fun one that you needed to watch, and I was excited. Also, because you're just kind of hard to find noir movies that I expect you haven't seen. I was like,
yeah,
he's a little
yeah,
better
no,
educated
this is...
than I am on in this genre, especially.
Yeah, this is one that definitely missed me, not by, you know what? So I do remember the marketing around this film. And it's, you know, it's McDonald's tie-ins and some of the commercials and the toys and this, that, and the third. I even watched this week the Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, the episode dedicated to, you know, Dick Tracy. And they bring up some of the interesting things you bring up, too. Like, this is right in the wake of, you know, Batman and sort of the firestorm that was. How this kind of felt like it was cashing in on some more of that comic book, you know, nostalgia characters that have lived with us for a little bit. So I had always, I think I maybe saw Roger Rabbit and that being more of the animated twist to it before I caught a hold of Dick Tracy or was aware of Dick Tracy or however
yeah.
that worked out in the VHS lineup. And I always thought that Dick Tracy was maybe a copy of Roger Rabbit, sort of like a lesser than property. I think that's why I never engaged with it as a kid. Like, I had the video game, and it was like, oh, that's not Roger Rabbit. It's kind of like not the
yeah.
real
oh,
thing.
Oh, the video game also is a great touchstone of like, I played that video game way more than I watched this movie, 100%.
Yeah. And, you know, I was interested to hear, too, that for whatever reason, this you know, the special effects of the makeup, the grotesqueness of the film was something you were responding to as a kid. I think I don't know if I would have responded to as well as a child as I did as an adult with this. I think this is sort of riding a little bit of that line of who is this for, and had a very
oh,
similar
yeah.
experience. We talked about another film I watched earlier this year, and that was Popeye, Robert Altman's Popeye. And I had, you know, very similar reactions to that film that I'm having where it feels like the, you know, the director of this project is, you know, has, you know, very strong ties to this when, you know, he was a child and he's sort of like reliving a little bit of that. And there's a commitment to the visual. Please.
Jumanji is also is one that it reminds me of, where it was like, for me, watching Jumanji as a kid was like, This is maybe not for me. I don't know what's going on with this movie. This is a little going off. Like it does kind of feel like that, where depending on what age you're at, it is very much a who is this movie for.
Yeah. So I was running up against that a little bit, and I think it was good that I saw it as an adult, because I'm not really sure I would have vibed with it all that much as a kid, even though
yeah,
there are a lot
enough.
Of these properties being kind of thrown at us, and a lot of the aesthetic of even Tim Burton's Batman that this is swimming in the wake of is in that 30s
yeah.
gangster sort of aesthetic. So whatever, we were getting a lot of that as kids, but I there's a more violent touch in some areas to this one. There's obviously more titillating touch to this one as we brought it with Madonna in a scene that I, you know, if I had known that was in there as a kid, I actually think Dick Tracy was more of my favorite, but I didn't. But I love this film from the first frame to the last one. I was in love with the production design, the makeup and costume. The commitment to the, I believe it was 7 primary colors that they stick to. I thought all that was incredible. How visually bombastic it was, and to see all the might of a studio backlot kind of being put to work here, and then you got Victoria here behind the camera. It's like, well, I wonder if we could, I don't know if we'll ever get something like, you know, or we really haven't, but something this like commitment to practicality, to just staging it in front of the camera. It was all very cool. There's One thing, however, that I did not vibe with in this film, and I'm going to have to save that for after the spoilers. It's the one key thing that I think I really think set this film back a peg, and probably why, even though it did make some money, it didn't necessarily continue in the way, or we didn't see, you know, Dick Tracy 2 or 3.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that after the break, but I was like, that's the one disappointing thing that kind of needed that to, you know, you kind of need to nail that for future interest in the property or to kind of see it continue past that. But other than that, this is a fantastic film. This even led me to purchasing some Dick Tracy comics. Like, I've started reading a recent run that was, I think out in 2004 or 2000.
Okay.
But it's a very like a hard-boiled detective kind of like take on the character.
Is it still going? Because like you mentioned the violence up top. I know that was something that, you know, kind of in reading about the making of and the history of the character and stuff this week leading up to the episode. Like,
right,
the original strip was also criticized for being like more violent than some of its like peers in the comics world in the. You know, 30s, whenever this was coming out. And the original comic author is like, one of the quotes that he has is something like where he was like, well, it's, I don't print anything worse than like an average policeman sees on an average night. Like they see way more blood in their line of work than we're putting in the papers. So it's just like, apparently this has always been something that has been like, kind of had a weird, not quite sure who the audience is, because it is like committed to being a little grittier than some of its peers, but also it is a like primary color, you know, comic strip, hard boiled, you know, very, very pulpy, like less trying to both be a more broadly accessible version of these like dark, seedy tales. But then at the same time being a like grittier, violent version of this popular broad medium of like comic strips, and like trying to find that sweet spot where it's balancing the two is something like weirdly inherent to this franchise's identity.
And I think I would have appreciated if I were Warren Beatty, like, you know, I'm growing up in the 40s. I think he was born in 37, so maybe like 40s, 50s.
I'm surprised you haven't given me a joke about me and Warren coming up together in school.
I had it coming up with the opening of the Big Bang. We'll get there. But because it leans a little into these people, and one of the thrills for him, or at least what he talks about in some of the behind the scenes for the, like the making of the Dick Tracy that came out in the 90s with this film, ended up watching that little half hour documentary.
Yeah,
he brings up, you know, the grotesqueness of the characters, or just seeing how they were, and matter of fact, Ebert brings that up as well, like how the characters were drawn was just in a real appeal for him. And there's one character in specific I'm going to talk about later on in the episode where it's just like the way they executed on how that looks from the page to, you know, the actual turnaround of the characters. It's like, oh, fantastic. Like, I love it. The casting, so, and everything, good. Like the mega design and everything is incredible.
Yeah.
So I think that is something that I could see scaring. I mean, because there were, this is weird. I don't like horror, obviously, but little bits of violence that I was exposed to a little earlier in life, like I mentioned, like Full Metal Jacket was something I was watching way too early. RoboCop, I mean, the violence at the beginning of RoboCop is definitely not a movie for kids, but it's something I really, really was drawn to as a child. So they're like little spurts of thriller-esque violence that I like, and I think this would have been right in hand of I like Dick Tracy. I didn't even realize it. Let's talk about some other people, Mickey, that I like this property as much as we do. Anybody you thought that would have this on their shelf?
I mean, I think the obvious choice, like this is almost like a time machine version of this movie, but like Robert Rodriguez definitely did Sin City. Like Robert Rodriguez taking Frank Miller's source material for Sin City is so much of like seeing exactly what Warren Beatty did with the source material in this, like the commitment to like keeping the look of the original material and like trying to translate that into 35 millimeter film as best as possible, and like the editing style of movies and how you could make something seem like a comic book. Like, that this has definitely got to be something that it inspired him when he was coming, like, deciding to make that movie at the very least.
Absolutely. I mean, I brought up Altman and Popeye a little earlier in my breakdown. Obviously, I feel like Warren was drawing from Altman in the commitment to the design, in my opinion. Or at least we're going to translate exactly what the comic books look like into live action. And you're going to think I'm biting off you. I swear to God I wasn't, but I'm reading a lot of the comics these days. I went Mike Mignola in my head with the Hellboy. It just like that sort of like flat graphic design, like heavy blacks that, I mean, you brought up Frank Miller. So, you know, they're two peas in a pod in terms of like visual stylistically. So, we went run along the same line there. But fantastic world can see, like, I love, as black and white as the morality appears, there's a little bit of that noir gray area that I kind of like with some of these characters.
Del Toro, too. Del Toro's another one that I think, like, lives in this, like, very saturated colors. Like, you know, I could see this being something that was influential on him as well.
Right.
Did you catch Frankenstein? Did you?
I haven't watched it yet.
No, I haven't watched it yet either. I was thinking about watching it coming. We'll chat about it. See if we decide to mention it on mic. But
yeah, for sure. You know what? For whatever reason, you know, we can cut this, or like maybe cut to break it at some point before this. But what do you think about James Gunn as far as a commitment to the comic book? But even like, we're going to get a tad more violent than you expect in certain areas. I feel like certain sequences in Suicide Squad got even more dark or twisted than I thought we were going to get there, but we're going to show Starro on screen in a sillier way than you've ever seen before.
Yeah, completely just played straight. Yeah.
Right. It feels like there's the where that led to, and that sort of weird sensibility now sort of overriding the entire DC, whatever DCU project or ethos now. It feels like, and I haven't watched much of
Peacemaker,
but I'm assuming we get there too in terms of like the level of violence, but the commitment to sillier elements in the comic book. But it seems like maybe he borrowed on that ethos. Well, yeah, let's get into the opening of this film and making fun of McGee a little bit more after this.
The long-awaited old man joke.
Sounds like you're trying to seduce me. And this old Seamus can smell it when a chippy's pulling a flim-flam. What are you hiding?
Here, step into my headquarters quickly while Eric isn't listening. Just move those boxes. Yeah, just look out for that pasta, and you go just sit at it. Just sit on the floor. Okay, so I've been getting these visions. A vision of an ominous future for the podcast where we need your help to look through the older episode. There's clues scattered from the future in the previous episodes. And we need extra eyes, yes. We need you to get your friends involved and maybe send them an episode of a movie that they've already seen, or a movie that you'd like to talk to them about, and get the link. Get the link right now. Don't forget. Pause while you're listening to this bit. I'll just ramble for a minute here while you look through the feed for an episode to send a friend. Yes, another vision of the future I've seen where there's terrible advertisements infecting the podcast, and only you can stop it by going to our Patreon and tossing us a few dollars. Yes, a few dollars could hold back the evil waves of sports betting and TV dinners sent in the mail that are somehow supposed to be healthy and responsible choices. Even though TV dinners used to be shorthand for, like, giving up. Anyway, I've got to get back to the episode before Eric gets suspicious. But did you find an episode to send to a friend? Did you have a friend in mind? Text them before it's too late!
Welcome back from break. We're in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be spoiling the film, starting with the Big Bang, seeing if it sizzles or fizzles. And we're gonna ask McGee right up top. So you live the lad. I'm already butchered.
You're so excited to make fun of me.
So you grew up much like this latchkey kid, McGee, out of it.
Yeah, stealing sandwiches out of trash cans.
It didn't come out as naturally. We're just gonna cut this.
I'm leaving it all in, you bastard. This is what you get. But you know, you're not wrong. I grew up with a smudge of dirt on my nose, picking perfectly prepared peanut butter sandwiches out of a trash can.
I thought it was a ham and cheese. A little like peanut butter.
Oh, was it? I didn't inspect it that closely, I'll be honest. But
I was kind of curious about what it was. It looked like a little ham and cheese sandwich.
It's got to be like an onion and cheese sandwich because it's the 30s, so it's got to be a little bit more depressing than usual.
Okay. Interesting. Because that is how we get the, I've been watching a little, you're George Motz fan. You like the hamburger, I forget what the, what's his, Hamburger America. You ever see that documentary?
It sounds familiar, but it's like the hamburger guy,
famous hamburger dude, goes around the country, documents different hamburger styles, blah blah blah. But he brings that up in the third, I believe, in the 30s, where the Oklahoma fried onion burger was the first hamburger because cheese had come into the picture for obvious reasons. So that was kind of, I don't know. We're gonna cut all that. None of that worked. McGee, let's talk about that opening. I'm a big fan of the black and white Touchstones picture logo.
I'm sorry. You trying to just move on. It's so funny. Let's talk about that opening. All right, let's try that one more time.
McGee, I'm a big fan of the black and white Touchstone Pictures logo. Love how that came in. And we start here with you know what's crazy? So as far as what's his name? Was it Charlie Cosmo?
Yeah. Oh yeah, the kid.
As soon as he's on screen, I'm like, I know that face. And I couldn't I swear to God, like maybe the middle of the movie, and I was like, oh, Hook.
That's Hook, baby. I know this kid.
I could not picture for the first. I was like, some of that, like maybe some of the plotting of it's going to kind of fly over me a little bit. Because for 40 minutes, I was trying to place his face. I was like, where do I know this kid from? I know I'm butchering that. I apologize. But Cosmo, I believe, is our entrance into the, so he's our little latchkey kid, and he stumbles upon a illegal card game, and I'm assuming these are Lips Manless men, or like his squad that's being attacked. Another great Paul Sorvino performance. This is incredible. Paul Sorvino, Goodfellas, Paulie and Goodfellas, so this is... star-studded cast. We're getting started immediately. What do we think about this opening, McGee? The illegal card game.
I absolutely love it. I mean, just setting up the here's a bunch of like really ridiculous cast of characters, and then immediately killing them off, like so that you just as soon as you learn their names and their gimmicks, then they're just gunned down. As like setting up, like this is the kind of world that you are. Like these are larger than life characters that are completely disposable. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously that gets extended into like Lips, who we get for a tiny bit and then is immediately replaced by the like actual big bad, which is going to be obviously Pacino's character. So this opening as like an amuse-bouche of the rest of the movie come is very fun. The turnaround reveal of Littleface is got to be... one of the best effects. Just like you sit down, this is the movie you're watching. This guy's name is Littleface. He's got a real little face, and now he's dead. This is all you need to know. It's like
Littleface,
Littleface, large head. Definitely Irish. We definitely have to shop at the same hat stores.
I love this opening. I'm in love with everything. the, like you said, the commitment to the prosthetics and making them feel like we're just ripping these people directly out of the comic books, and then how effective I feel like they were. Because yes, there is that. There's a little bit of the, like, you can see a little bit of the glue in some areas or the stitching in some areas, but it feels so good. Like, in terms of how well it was rendered and executed, and we get little pop marks in the skin or little boils in areas, how well folds fold over and people like the brow and the sense of that. I love the prosthetics in this beginning. I will say I'm in love with the first time we get the back shot of Tracy at the play, and he's with True Heart, and you know, they kind of do the side profile as they talk to each other, and we see the radio watch, and he, you know, makes his exit off, you know, screen right. Love that kind of seeing that shot. But I wish we had a better, like, heroic entrance to the character. It felt very plain, in my opinion, or sort of it didn't have the pizzazz, it didn't have the heroic entrance that we've talked about in a number of films.
Yeah.
He just kind of, like, as the police car kind of rolls up, he just kind of gets out of the back of it, and he's like, everyone's like, ah, Tracy, as he's walking onto the scene. I had brought the one of the Tracy recent comic books by Alex Segura and Michael Morisi, I believe it is. And they knew what you do when you introduce Dick Tracy, particularly a man, a detective in an all yellow kind of overcoat and hat. Like, you got to give that the shot, the Dutch tilt, you know, from afar, the heroic cowboy pose.
Which I think they do later better.
Yeah,
it's like this.
Yes.
The beginning of this movie definitely makes you. It's set up as if you already are a big fan. It's like this movie assumes that he's as famous in our world as he is in his, like, starting out with the press, like, swarming him as he's leaving the opera and being like, are you gonna get Big Boy Caprice? And he's like, oh, why don't you shave that mustache? And, you know, he's got this kind of, like, yuck relationship with the press already that establishes him as, like, you know, everybody wants him to be mayor. Like, he is already firmly at the height of his popularity, which, you know, obviously, screenplay wise, he's gonna come down from there so that we can have the, you know, the dark night that he has to go through in the screenplay. But, like, I do kind of wish that montage that hits the iconography harder, I think it is missing from this opening a little bit.
It's a little I'm gonna save you for my compliment sandwich, but this is a great setup. The play, like I said, the shot, I almost kind of wish we didn't get the shot of him leaving the apartment and then we zoom out of that building to kind of see the rest of this incredible matte painting that we fly over. And then I think that's when we make it to the kid. But I kind of wish the first shot we get of Tracy was in that opera house and we first get the silhouetted profile and then maybe a more heroic shot. I think that would have been way more effective. But is there a scene out of this that you would show to get them to watch? Like I said, if you would have shown me the Breathless Mahoney scene, I didn't realize that was in here. You know, because I understand you, Pac, now. I really didn't understand the Pac and Madonna connection. or the Big Daddy Kane and Madonna.
You just imagining Pac watching Dick Tracy, like, all right.
Like,
more Beatty,
okay,
passed up on this? All right.
I understand this now, all right. Because I never listen,
so
I'm going to be honest, I don't really listen to Madonna. I know some of the hits, and obviously I know her as a pop culture figure, but the Madonna appeal has just missed me. We didn't grow up with Madonna in the house, so I don't know
a lot
about her. But I love her.
Your history of being aggressively straight is well documented on this podcast, so I didn't expect you to be
a
secret Madonna fan.
I didn't even know
that's
a straight thing, to be honest.
I'm just saying, if a man's into Madonna's music, then it's usually a gay man, yes.
But yeah, I was like, okay, I get the Madonna thing.
She's an icon for a reason. Again, I'm gonna, you know, get into my, like, queer mode for a minute, but she fucking, like, icon in this fucking movie. Like, she absolutely rips. Like, presence in my life as an artist either, but definitely just. You gotta respect, especially, you know, not that you know, you mentioned the like her like working for SAG minimum up top and whatever. Like, that's not required to prove your loyalty to the material or whatever, whatever. Like, definitely nothing wrong with earning what you're, you know, getting paid what you're worth or whatever. But just the commitment to, like, no, I'm going to, this is my part. I'm going to chase it because I have something that I'm doing with it. Like, her turning on the water, that's my scene that I would get to show someone to watch, by the way, is Madonna and Pacino in the rehearsal scene.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
When Pacino's just, like, in full, like, Trump at a teen beauty pageant show mode, like, just creeping around, just, like, singing along, which is so, because that is one,
he has it in his bed.
Yeah, his physicality with it, where he's, like, really leaning into the prosthetics, instead of just feeling like he's, like, weighed down by them, he's, like, allowing it to feed into his performance and just make him more vile and more monstrous to, like, reflect the grotesque, like, aesthetic of the movie that he's in. Like, he's really meeting the movie at its material. And Madonna in that scene is just like, oh, okay, like, this is what we're doing? Like, I'm gonna bust out the fucking waterworks, like, in the middle. You know, I'm gonna, like, cry real tears in this rehearsal scene. And it's like, damn, this is Dick. Did nobody tell these people we're working on Dick Tracy? Like, this is a wild level of performance in this scene. But yeah, so that would be the scene that I would get to show somebody, just of like, do you want to watch, like, Madonna and Pacino just, like, really, really, really give it in this movie more than you're expecting?
Because, like, I love that scene as well, and this is where he's, like, just being this trollish fucking
just completely lecherous. Yeah. What I love about it is it's something. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Let me set you up with this really quick. Like, it does feel like in some areas Pacino's being a little more handsy in front of the camera than I think. I'd be very curious of, like, what conversation went on behind that, or if he just went, because there's a shot where he tries to grab her ass, but she's already turned, so the timing of it is off. So I'm wondering if
it's, like, so awkward. Like, at her weirdly. So right. I looked up some stuff about that. There is an interview with Pacino later where he says he thinks about that day of shooting all the time because Madonna was, like, flashing him whenever she was off camera, was, like, specifically, like, letting her dress slip and stuff to, like, try and trip him up. And so they were, like, kind of fucking with each other. It's this is obviously from Pacino's storytelling, so, like, but, like, also doesn't sound completely out of character for Madonna to do. So it does seem, it makes that scene a little bit more palatable, that it does seem like a creative, like, them fucking with each other to, like, really amp up the intensity of the scene a little bit.
And I don't mind him as a handsy character. It's just, like, if the timing looked off on screen, I was like, then I'm like, oh, I wonder,
you're,
if, like,
you did you tell
then.
Her that you were doing that? Yeah.
Yeah, we got to get that. We got to get that right.
That's some consent's important here in with your scene partner, for sure. I do that scene just makes me think of, like, you know, obviously gives me Trump vibes. But the, like, specifically, there's moments where, like, Trump is an evil, obviously, piece of shit, but he's funny as hell. And, like, there's times where he's just funny, and it's like, man, you should have been a queen. Like, if you were a sassy gay man, you would be so much happier of a person. Like, you would still be a piece of shit. Like, and I still wouldn't want you around, but you would be, like, contained in your world being a sassy, just completely bitchy. Yeah, exactly. Like, the encroaching, demolishing of our country. If you you had just, like, had somebody to bitch at and make fun of instead of having destroying to take your frustrations country. Out on everyone else. Yeah.
Let me tell you the thing that I noticed that I hadn't, because I watched it a couple times, obviously. I'm a big fan of this film now. We have some repeat offenders, and some repeat offenders hopping off right off of our last pick in Thief.
Yeah.
Tom Siglieri is here, our Intiglia from Thief. You want some milk? He's the cook in the diner.
I didn't even recognize him, but that is him, huh?
Yeah. And we got James Caan. Yeah,
obviously, James Caan. It's like, right, I don't think I will, or whatever he says.
And I didn't even recognize him, because I saw his name in the credit, and I was like, oh, shit. Like, you know, I was waiting for the James Caan scene. It wasn't until I'm like, and I guess I didn't really, you know, I'm watching the movie, I'm not really thinking about it. And then when it ended, I was like, where was James Caan at? I the credits, like, that was Caan? He did not read to me. Did that read to you the first time?
No, it didn't at all. I did the same thing, literally the exact same thing. The credits rolled, and I was like, wait a minute, hold on. And I had to look, Google it, and then it was like, oh, shit. Yeah, he does have one line and then explodes off camera. Like, that's a wild reuse of him, but okay.
And there's a little, not even a little bit, a lot of that, because this is a star-studded cast. Dick Van Dyke is in it, is the twisted DA mayor thing. There's a Kathy Bates was in it. Well, I didn't even realize who Kathy Bates was. And I was like, oh, she was the court stenographer, I believe.
See, I didn't even realize that either.
Yeah,
damn.
I believe she's the one right at the hallway at the beginning. There's a
obviously
Paul
Hoffman.
Savino. Yeah, you know what? So this is I didn't particularly love the Hoffman cameo. How tied it felt like to Rain Man. It felt like he was just doing Rain Man again. I don't know if you if that's maybe a blind.
It did also. I just don't like his prosthetics either. It was like I had read that like his prosthetics were like the most intensive. Like he had the longest in the makeup chair of anyone.
Is that right?
And it's like, he just looks like Dustin Hoffman with his face sliding a little bit, like, you know, like,
yeah.
That was the least successful.
Yeah, didn't pick the gear for the Hoffman. Everyone else for the like prune face. I love when prune face is at the Tracy is first put in the bug inside of the club, and then prune like when he breaks in under the guise of just like looking for gambling, and prune face like jumps out of his chair, like, I'd never be caught in a place with gambling. Which is the close-up on that face. Incredible. I love that. Let's talk about compliments.
That's right. It's like people I don't understand the complaints about the screenplay with this movie, where it's like, oh, the screenplay is a little straightforward, and it's like, yeah, dude, do you want the prune face to be delivering like some real like thick complicated dialogue? Like, right. No, the bit is that his name's prune face and his face is all pruned up. Like, that you don't want him to also be delivering a monologue that you have to think about. You're just thinking about prune face. Like, know what you're here for.
Just kind of knowing what film you're in.
Yeah.
Here's where I will give a little of those critiques some credence, because we're going to hop into my compliment sandwich. And like I said, so many fantastic people were cast. The casting in this is A1, with one exception.
Oh.
Not into Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy. I think this is the fatal flaw of the film. I've liked Warren Beatty, and he's obviously a legend. Shampoo, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Bonnie and Clyde. There's some classics, and I've liked him as much as, you know, let me not get sidetracked. I've liked him in some different roles. Here, I feel like he was so, one, he's about 30 years too old. And in a lot of ways, it kind of feels like, I like an old, like Humphrey Bogart is an older man in noirs, but he's still, there's a vitality, there's a charisma there, and which what I'm not getting from Beatty in this role. I feel like a lot of his reaction shots are just like, I'm gonna do my Warren Beatty for you here really quick. He's just going like anything he's being talking, he's just like, just like lips parted, kind of for the whole shot. I don't understand. It feels like.
Can you imagine if they put him in prosthetics like they're originally going to? If he was just
were
like
they?
Apparently, I read something that he was supposed to wear prosthetics like everyone else was to make him more square jawed, because he wanted the like his face to be square and his shoulders to be squared off to make him look like really comic book striking.
Yeah.
And then he was just like, he's like, there was just no expression on my face. It was just any like close ups of me would be completely lifeless and emotionless.
And it feels
like
that.
Yeah, it's not that far off, but I can imagine why. He made the right choice for sure, but yeah, I don't know. I see what your point though for sure.
Not. And you know what? When we get to Multiverse Casting Couch, because I got somebody that would not only would have saved this, is you cannot beat me when it comes to it. I swear to God. I don't care who you have on your list. When you hear who we've talked about him in the past, this would have been A1 casting, incredible, save this franchise. It would have been much more in line, I think, with not only the tone of the character, but the charisma that it needed, please.
Oh, I'm excited to hear what your pick is, because I have a pick in mind too. I wonder.
Let's save it for after the break.
This showdown after the break.
Yeah, hell yeah.
But before we get to that, though, do we have anything for the Grover Cleveland's presidential time machine?
I wanted to thank you for finding Grover Cleveland's presidential time machine for me. I'll give him your regard.
You know what? I kind of gave it away a little bit with my James Gunn bit, but where we committed to the aesthetic of the comic book, and we weren't at a time, even like I said, I brought up Altman, and this is in the 80s. I forget exactly when Popeye was. Actually, maybe Popeye was the 70s. I'm so bad with dates right now. Hold on.
I think, yeah, late 70s, early 80s. I can't remember.
1980. So Popeye in the 80s. This in the 90s, even Batman in the 90s, there was, and even into that Joel Schumacher at a point in time where we weren't embarrassed by the comic book aesthetic and we embraced that. And then somewhere in that mid 2000, you know, that's when, you know, when Bryan Singer and the X-Men start getting a hold, like we start kind of getting like, we start toning down some of the more comic booky elements of it. And in this later, you know, Marvel 2008 revival, it started like, no, we really are just gonna like rip some of this stuff from the pages and not be embarrassed of some of the more comic booky elements and characters that I feel like it's like why you read some of this stuff or why you engage some of these properties is because like I just love the way Flat Top looks, and I'm gonna talk about that glowingly, you know, moving forward to our next section. So in the different, I think we're in this decade, the decade that it looks really, you know, appreciates the very look, and
we're kind of like coming back around to leaning into the medium and like not being afraid of taking inspiration from it when need be. I think like Marvel especially has gone through different phases of like leaning into that and then leaning away from it. And but like the culture at large is a little bit less afraid of the more fantastical elements. I think this movie feel like if this movie was made in the modern day, one, I think you obviously have to like keep it in its original like pulpy time period. Mm-hmm. But this is such a Netflix movie. Like, this is just a Netflix original that they spent a bunch of money on. Like, because this is never, in the modern day, this is never going to make its money back in a theatrical release. And especially with all of the stunt casting of having a bunch of big names do a silly thing that they wouldn't otherwise do. Like I was saying up top, like, it's harder to get that impact because that's so much more common these days of, like, you know, kind of well-respected people. I think, like, you know, like Leo is one of the, DiCaprio is one of the last that isn't like doing a superhero movie or whatever. Like it would take somebody like that has actively avoided the genre.
Do you know that was his advice to Chalamet, or is like, you know, I think it was like no cocaine and no superhero movies or something like that.
Something like that.
Would you consider Dune that sort of role, like his superhero role, or is that more sophisticated?
I think he's trying to meet it in the middle. I think Dick Tracy is so much, like, especially with the, like, grotesque, you know, special effects kind of spectacle nature of it. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Like, that doesn't feel like a Dune, that feels like a big Netflix movie. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of those Netflix movies that the headline is that it's the most expensive movie ever, you know. They spent as much or more money on it than Dune, but it still ends up looking like a streaming movie. It feels like it'd be something more like that, where you would have to get somebody of that caliber to do it, to make it exciting, because otherwise it's just like, Jack Black's like doing your Netflix movie or whatever. Like, it's not that.
I almost feel like the people who would be interested in Dick Tracy, or, you know, seeing that property come to life again, are already past.
They're too old. Yeah,
it's, I don't even know what that generation is.
The people I was thinking of, where I was like Harrison Ford would be, who's, you know, just did the fucking Captain America movie, like kind of hesitantly and talk shit about it. But like, I think you need those kind of like elder statesman guys, or, you know, somebody to come back from something like. You know, we did that with Michael Keaton in the Flash movie that everyone hated, where it was like, oh, cool, like Michael Keaton coming back reprising Batman, and then it was like, oh, well, yeah, that was not worth the headline.
Or Tyson fighting what's the motherfucker's name?
Oh, Donnie
Jake
Yen.
Paul. No.
I thought you were talking about the like It Man.
Sad. We're just like, this is sad.
Yeah.
I don't watch this. I'll tell you some stuff I do want to watch. Some of these performances. Let's talk about it after the break.
He once sweet-talked a magic hour into a magic year. His cinematography has won Best Supporting Actor 2 years in a row. Robert Redford cried watching him dance, and was struck with the inspiration to create Sundance. He is the most interesting DP in the world.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I prefer Make Me Watch. Stay tuned, my friends.
All right, we're going under the lights, breaking down our favorite performances here. I mean, obviously, we got this star-studded cast. Yeah. This Oscar nominated cast here.
Yeah. Do we have any winners? Was there, cause I know we won for makeup and, special effects, I believe. I'm not sure if anybody.
And Madonna won for best original song, Madonna and Sondheim, I believe they also, yeah. But, our obvious and deserving, nominee here is, Pacino.
Standout of the film. Like, I love this
incredible,
like the small stuff,
so,
like his laugh.
I can't even pick one scene that I love. Like, usually in things like this, it's like, oh man, like he's really giving it in this scene where he's really having fun. He's having fun in every fucking scene. Even in like tiny little moments that aren't even real scenes, like when he finds the microphone and he's just making noises, just like a fucking rabid dog. Like, it's just incredible performance.
I love too the physicality that he brought to it. Like, I think your scene is a great example of him kind of like hovering and swimming around around these girls, but he's sort of like trying to like dance and command too. It's just, it's so weird.
He just wishes he was a showgirl, but he can't give up the life. That's what I'm telling you. It's Trump.
I love the quote, speaking of Trump, like the quotes that he'll just say in a tribute to just random people, or it's like Abraham Lincoln, it's like Nietzsche.
The one scene where he loses his train of thought, where he's quoting random philosophers while he's like dragging off the hostage, Dick Tracy's girlfriend.
Right,
he's
quoting
random philosophers, and then he's like, wait, hold on, I had a thought. Nope. Nope, I lost it. Never mind. Let's go. They just moves on like
an incredible character. But I even got to give my A1 performer in this one is William Forsythe, who I know from Blue Streak, Martin Lawrence, and I think it was Luke Wilson is the trio in Blue Streak, a cop comedy from back in the day. William Forsythe here plays Flat Top. I feel like that was the best execution.
I didn't know that was who was under all that makeup.
Yeah. Who when you think of his face, I'm just like, oh, that's perfect casting. Like, I just love
that,
like,
he's really good
that
casting. Holy shit.
Yeah, like seeing that under the makeup. And I love, you know, the voice, the character of Flat Top, like how he brought that to life. I was a really, really big fan of, particularly outside of the door where he like plays the orphanage or the head of the child protective services. Yeah. He's like, we want the kid. Or it's like, and then the other dude, I believe, with him is Itchy. So how he'll just like repeat everything he'll say in the background. Like, we don't want the kid, Kappa. Yeah, we don't want the kid, Kappa. How he does that. But all of it was fantastic. I loved it.
Man, you know, my favorite performer, I think, the one that in this wild star-studded cast, obviously love Madonna's performance. I already sung her praises there. But we were talking about earlier, like Charlie Cosmo is so good in this movie for being, and like, you know,
Charlie had a run there in the 90s.
So good in Hook. Yeah. What about Bob, which I've referenced as being a potential pick for the pod, except when I tried to make you watch it, I was like, this is too miserable of a movie. I'm not in the mood for it this week. And I called an audible. But he's great in that movie, too. He's great in this movie. The moment that he genuinely got me to, like, laugh out loud at the screen when he orders the second coffee at the diner. Okay, when, like, Dick Tracy sits down, like, orders the coffee, and he's like, yeah, I'll take one, too. Just, like, the way he carries himself with the confidence that is, like, completely believable for this little orphan kid. Absolutely. Fucking hilarious. Like, his comedic timing, just absolutely great performer. One of my, you know, going into the best line reads, you know, not to skip ahead a little bit, but him going with the, or when they're talking about him, and she's like, what do I do with the, I can't remember, what do I do with the eating machine? And Dick Tracy's just like, I don't know, watch him. Watch him do what? It's just like, they really just fucking nail that little kid's personality. Yeah. Which would so easily be grating, especially in something this cartoony, and like how I think, you know, you brought up like Warren Beatty being not really working for you in this role. Mm-hmm. I think him trying to make this character so wholesome, where because this world is so over the top and grotesque, that Dick Tracy is supposed to represent this like Americana wholesome thread that is, you know, being protected here, is like he's giving up the nuclear family to try and protect it for everyone else. And so like him having this very like plain white bread boring personality, I think is intentional, like for what they're going for, and at least to try and make it at least somewhat broadly accessible. And in that context, it would be so easy for the kid to suck so hard, for the kid to just be the worst part of this movie. And I think part of the reason why Beatty stands out as such a weak spot in this movie is just because everyone around him is so fucking good. Even the kid, the love interest, the femme fatale, like all your villains, like just everybody's fucking hitting here. Absolutely. And so it's like the fact that he's kind of your blank slate is a weak spot, but it's like, well, yeah, I get it. Like, I see what you were doing. Why you? It feels like you made that weak intentionally there.
Let me tell you who I feel like we could have improved in this weak spot. Multiverse casting couch of madness. Who else could we have seen in these roles? We're gonna have our showdown. Do you want to hit me first with your selection, the one that you had in mind, or do you want me to?
I accidentally spoiled it already, but I do think Harrison, like prime Harrison Ford in 1990, is so, like, I think that a little bit of the gruffness, you need a little bit of scruff, you need a little bit of like sex appeal.
I've never been a super, later stage Harrison Ford, like what we're seeing now in kind of what he did with the, what was it, A New Hope? Or not A New Hope. What was the new trilogy? Whatever the new trilogy was.
Oh, the Force Awakens.
I liked him kind of what he's doing in Force Awakens. I like older Harrison Ford in his grumpier years in this kind of time period. I'm not super big, young.
Was he? There's never years that he had that weren't grumpy. I think he was born. He was born grumpy. He's gonna die grumpy.
Grumpy persona. Kind of light indie. You know.
What about like? Did you see What Lies Beneath? Is that a future pick?
Put on our radar. Yeah.
Oh, that's a pick that, because that is like a prime, like Harrison Ford being going from a like middle-age sex appeal to, like, getting like into Air his Force elder One. Statesman sex appeal. Yeah. Okay. And that's going to be a fun one, because that's a really... Yeah. It's a sneakily good movie, for sure.
Let me tell you, we've already covered him, but I feel like he has the face, the charisma, the physicality, because there's a moment where he has to, like, hop onto the street lamp, and then on top of the car. That's a little rough, I'm not going to lie to you, in terms of just, like, the physicality of it.
I mean, that's 100% a stunt performer. You can watch the guy... It's 100% a body double, because they're in a wide. They like cut from Warren Beatty, obviously on a sound. And then I love the stunt performer absolutely over jumps the jump and biffs his head off the pole is my favorite part. I watched. I went back and rewound that because it was hilarious. I was like, oh man, we couldn't have gotten another take of that where he didn't fucking bounce his skull off of the pole like.
And we've already covered him in the past in a film that I had also in this same year I had a lot of trouble with in Tremors, McGee. But Fred Ward as Dick Tracy. Ward as Dick Tracy. That is like, he was born to play Dick Tracy.
I think the look is perfect. I think he's got the grit. He's got the grime.
You need no prosthetics.
He doesn't need prosthetics. He looks like he's already wearing a false chin. Like, I think
and
you're
he
not.
I don't think he has the appeal.
I don't think he has the appeal to hang this movie on. Which I don't.
Not in the casting sense, but you're already leaning towards the production design. You're already leaning towards the aesthetic of the film being the big draw of what we're seeing. You got somebody that like looks like Dick Tracy. I think you could sell Fred Ward. Or if not, if his name isn't big enough, we could do it with his son, fucking Punisher.
Wait, is that his son?
No, but I always think of
Thomas, what's his name? The guy I worked with, what's his name? He's in The Expanse.
John Bernthal.
Oh, you're talking about the new Punisher. I was talking about Thomas Jane.
Thomas Jane? No. John Bernthal is your new, if you do the Netflix one.
Oh, right. I forgot about that from the Tremors episode recently. Yeah. Should have been cast as father and son for sure. Yeah. No, that's a good one for sure. I like that.
I got two more for you in an honorary pick if those didn't
win. Okay.
A second pick, Dennis Quaid. Dennis Quaid in the 90s having himself a run. He has way more charisma. I mean, he's a bigger name and I think even more charismatic than Fred Ward. But I just like Fred Ward's look. He has more of a hard-boiled detective look to him. But killer smile. Obviously, things went off the rails a little bit recently. But a young Dennis Quaid, like a Great Balls of Fire.
What did Dennis Quaid do?
He's super mega weird.
I expect they're all anybody from that generation. Kind of assume by default is.
Yeah, but young Dennis Quaid, Great Balls of Fire, Dennis Quaid. I can kind of see me Dennis Quaid. Third one, bigger name than all three that we've mentioned. But I don't know. Kurt Russell, had Kurt Russell in mind.
Kurt Russell would work.
Yeah.
Maybe Val Kilmer. He might be a little too young.
Okay.
But he's got the jawline for it.
Yeah. I don't know, him and kids, like if there's a real like warmth or like could he...
Oh yeah, this is 4 years after Top Gun. Val Kilmer could absolutely crush this, I think.
Yeah.
I think he's got the... I mean, for the same reason that he's going to get the Batman role a few years after this, is that I think he slots into that. Obviously, we can just pick Batman actors because it's basically the same thing that the producers were looking for, obviously.
Right. Honorary Michael Keaton, speaking of Batman.
Michael Keaton. See, I don't think Michael Keaton makes a good Bruce Wayne, but I don't...
You like Michael Keaton's Bruce Wayne? I've never liked his Bruce Wayne. I don't get it with Keaton. I'm going to be honest with you. We could cut this because it has nothing to do with it. I've never gotten the Keaton appeal. to be honest with you, that like I've never really even understood the Jack appeal of Joker. I've never really loved either of those guys.
Oh, yeah.
In those roles.
I am firmly, my hot take is that I like the Schumacher Batmans more than the Tim Burton ones. Mostly,
I think I like two more than I like either of Forever. Was it no Forever? Who did Forever? Did Schumacher do Forever? And
yeah, Forever and it? Batman and Robin are Schumacher.
And Batman and Robin, yeah,
Returns and
I think I like Returns more than
yeah. Returns is the best movie, but the one that I go back and watch more often is. Like what I go back and watch the Schumacher movies more than I watch the Burton ones, just because it's like it's funny, it's campy,
yeah.
It's something to put on and not really pay attention to, and until like a scene that you remember where you're like, okay, let me watch Tommy Lee Jr. or Tommy Lee Jones lose his fucking mind for a second. Like,
you know what? Always kind of annoyed me a little bit with the handling of Bane. We'll cut this because this is really going to get down a rabbit hole. But we did this with Nolan's films. We did this with the Schumacher films. We're kind of doing this a little bit with Absolute, where we turn Bane into sort of a lackey at some point. Like, he becomes he's the big bad until there's always someone behind the shadows controlling him. And
yeah.
Schumacher is Poison Ivy. And Nolan, we had Talia. And this one, it looks like it's going to be Joker. In Absolute Universe, it looks like it's going to be Joker. It always never feels like Bane gets his shine. Is kind of like...
Because he's supposed to be the anti-Batman, but then you can't have him be all... It's like...
I feel like he can. Like Tom King in the 2016 run of the comic books where Gotham Girl and Gotham whatever the dude's name was, and they go and steal Psycho Pirate, and like Bane's been living on this island, like not getting up to any shit, but he has like some people prisoner or whatever. Like I think you could do the Bane story in an interesting way that doesn't like require him to be somebody's fucking number two always. I don't know. I started to think about the Poison Ivy scenes in the Schumacher.
Yeah,
they always do Bane.
It's like, oh yeah,
like
Bane
that.
Is in that, huh? Oops.
Yeah. Who had a worse death? We didn't talk about this in the Thief episode, but who had a worse death? Talia al Ghul. What's that girl's name?
Marianne
Cotillard. Or Robert Prosky. Leo. The Thief. or do you like just a slow, like... or have her head with, like...
You could have cut out of that. Like, that's... Both... Okay, again, both of those are not the actor's fault. This is me...
I don't know. Hold on.
I'm a broken record. I am a broken record. But, like, if you're the director and you know that you're going to hang on that shot for that long, you got to be like, hey, yo, that's not, I'm going to still be in this, like.
You got to give me more than.
Yeah, no.
What am I going to do with? I can't do that with.
That's 100%. It's giving, like, I didn't actually have a plan for this long. I thought you were going to call cut by now. So it's like, should I fade out? And it's like, oh, I've already been thinking about this too long. I should just shut my eyes. Okay.
Oh, both terrible deaths.
But then, like, even Prosky, though, Prosky is like, if you slow anything down for that long, you can just microanalyze every like thought of him going like,
get up every 2 seconds.
Like,
then he would like fall, and then he'd go.
He's like, he's like settling down into something that's comfortable. He's like, oh, not
three different beats. I just need one. I don't know why you went from here to there to there.
Because it looks so much worse in slow. I mean, it's just like if you're directing it, you're like, brother, I'm shooting this in slow motion. You gotta just do one. You can't. You gotta tell him. You gotta let him know. They can't see it. He's out there with his head all exploded and shit. And like, yeah, oof. That's on them. That's not. That's such a tangent.
Hilarious. Let's hop back into this. Best line reads, McGee. Let's talk about him. So there are a lot of clever noirish lines. I do like a lot of them. But the one that's like the silly one, that's kind of a throwaway that just like fucking makes me crack up each and every time is, I think it was Flat Top. So this is after 88 Keys does the first bid for No Face, or whom, you know, the Breathless Mahoney alter ego to kind of, hey, we'll kill Dick Tracy for like 10%. And so he first offers, he's like, never bring me an offer, you know, if you don't know who it's from. So he's leaving. I think it was Flat Top that asked. He's like, yeah, you want me to follow him, boss? And then like the way Pacino delivers this line, and where he just like looks up casual. And this is why you hire Pacino, because he can throw away this. just out on a whim, he goes like, follow him where? To the piano? To the piano,
follow him where? To the piano. He has every single one of the best lines are all Pacino's lines. And it's like, some of them could come out of his mouth. I'm like, there's no way somebody wrote that for you, right? Like, there's right. No way.
Right? It just somebody, feels so natural.
I'm like, how would you ever assume that somebody could say that in a way that would not sound completely insane? When he ties him up in the boiler room and he's just like, you dumb dick, you have said goodbye to oxygen. He's like, what the f-?
When he like has a little explosion, he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
Oh, at the end in the like clock tower when he's like, yeah, he's like just like bipolar swinging from like, I'm not the one who did this. We're chill. Then he's like, you piece of shit off.
I'm so sorry. I don't know why I said that. Oh, great stuff. Love Pacino in this movie. Moving on to best fit.
He's so good. Yeah.
Costume designer, Melina, I think it's Cananiro, and Elizabeta Beraldo. And I know I butchered that. I apologize, ladies. But I also want to credit the makeup artist, John Coloni Jr. and Doug Drexler. And so I picked a Flat Top. Like I said, William Forsythe, the casting for one is just incredible because he has like the structure, the bone structure, and sort of the head structure that you need to sort of like build off of to create this incredible prosthetic around his face. The prosthetics were so genius in this film, and I think that's why it's maybe lasted the test of time and become sort of the cult favorite that it has been. The hair, everything, the look, the voice, his mannerisms, postures, particularly in this pose here, just spelling on the wall like "Eat Lead, Tracy." So every one of his shots and just the like the classic like little gap teeth spells that classic exaggerated film noir. The blend of this I like a lot. Yeah. And your next one is actually I Love Your Shot. This is love a lot of what you got going on here, McGee.
Yeah, I picked from the montage, specifically the one that made me giggle the most is him knocking over the group of dudes in primary colored suits, like a stack of bowling pins. But then just, you know, this is where you get some of the like iconography, you know, Dick Tracy low angle squared up with a Tommy gun. Like, you're getting some of those things that we were looking for in the beginning when you're really establishing the character. But just, yeah, this montage really nails all of the things that you want to see, when you're bringing a character like straight out of the page into this setting.
All right, welcome back from break. We're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and its curtain close. You can follow this segment in the show notes, where we'll post them in a shot that says shots. It'll lead you to a link to our Patreon page, which is free. You don't have to pay for it, but we do appreciate it if you do.
I'm just remembering that we also neglected to mention this Patreon post during our Best Fit segment, which you can also find the best fits from you know, a minute ago there. One of these days we'll remember to call that out during the segment and not after the break. But that's the kind of professionalism you get here, Make Me Watch.
Starting with our first shot here, which is actually a shared shot.
Yes, this hasn't happened in a while.
Longer. Yeah, it's been a minute since we had a A shared shot. But mine goes actually up and past the split diopter into
That matte painting at the end.
Into the matte painting. So you want to kick us off, and maybe I'll talk about why I included a little bit of that at the end.
Yeah, so this is the shot, I think, after Dick Tracy gets away. You see Pacino and the gang walking up, silhouetted perfectly. We have this, like, matte painting of a graveyard behind them that's matching this, like, moonlight silhouette rim that they have on them. I love when matte paintings aren't trying to hide themselves like this. The additional, like, we're not hiding the fact that we're doing this in front of a matte painting, but we're also matching the lighting perfectly, is just that great combination that really heightens this into such a beautiful image. But yeah, then it going from that into, you know, Pacino walking into his close up where he's actually lit. And so you get to see him chewing out. I think it's Dick Van Dyke there who's silhouetted, right? Yeah. And then we go from that shot to this beautiful split diopter with the reveal of Madonna waiting in the car, like slinking back out of frame. And then, you know, we go in extended. This whole like 4-shot sequence is just absolutely gorgeous here. So what do you got here?
Yeah, you know, I picked the shot too because of some of the reveal. So we get the slow reveal of them walking towards camera, and we just get this rim light. And what's beautiful about this rim light and just the character designs that we know immediately that this is Flat Top. We get a little bit of that color of green and blue on the rim light, so these feel like the gangsters and the posse. And we're hearing Pacino to kind of see his gang silhouetted as we're slowly revealing them. Then we get the reveal of Madonna, like you said, in the car, and I'm assuming we're suggesting that she's listening into the conversation. Well, you know, if you upon rewatch and knowing that she's kind of behind all of this, it's interesting to kind of see her, the little times in which she's sort of like, you know, asking certain, like she asks his 88 keys as he's leaving the room, like what was that all about? Like she's kind of poking and prodding to see how well her plan is working, you know, behind the scenes in two different forms of her character. We cut back and we get that reveal of Dick Van Dyke to say, oh shit, that's the mayor. That's who he was talking to the whole time. And like you mentioned, the end here with this fish-eyed lens kind of look to the world, and this graveyard is just really cool to end on this matte painting in the background of sort of the drama or the conspiratorial nature of what's going on at this graveyard.
Yeah.
and sort of the corruption of this town. So really cool in terms of like Victorio's use of silhouette and split diopter and cutting into the wide here, like just the different setups I find to be really interesting. And like the commitment again to pulling these shapes that we've seen in the comic book and how that immediately reads even in a silhouette of these guys walking immediately says who the gangsters are. Like, you know, obviously this isn't the cops or Tracy's crew.
Yeah.
Just based on the look of that Flat Top. So yeah, it's
such a brilliant use of the split diopter too, because it's like by nature of the medium in the comic books, you could have these like
things
in the foreground that are also perfectly sharp while you have this like dramatic silhouette in the background would also be perfectly sharp, because you're not going to do like depth of field in a print, a newspaper print. That's just not you don't have the fidelity, like the quality of print for it. So like leaning into that as these like split diopter shots, where they're a little bit jarring, but like, really do sell a visual language that is still like 100% like true to the comic book origins of it at the same time is a clever use of a like otherwise pretty specialized, you know, film technique here. I love the first time that we use the split diopter. It's on a can of beans that are just labeled beans.
Or I thought it was chili. Was it?
Was it chili? Yeah, I can't.
Chili.
It's so funny.
Yeah. But yeah, great stuff here. Great cinematography. I'm going to move on to my next shot, which is again, we're just borrowing from shots that we love, because this is taking place within the Best Fit shot that McGee talked about earlier, and this is the first montage of after Tracy has planted the bug in Big Boy Caprice's gambling nightclub, whatever hideout. He knows all his moves, and we're going on the heroic montage of him taking down all his scores throughout the town. So many reasons why I think that this is more of an effective heroic moment that we spoke about, or sort of a hero's entrance. And I think One of the things I love about the physicality of this character in as it's used in this film is dropping these frames and creating these speed ramps. So when he does some of these, you know, exaggerated punches or movements, they sort of read with a little bit more force than I'm assuming a 57-year-old, you know, Warren Beatty looked like in the moment. Yeah. It actually feels like he's, you know, a man that could knock 8 guys out at the same time with a single punch in the way that this shot was delivered. So a really effective use of that technique and that speed ramp that I like a lot. And just these colors are so vibrant and bright. And even when you – so, I mean, the same red that we're using for the overcoats or the same red that's going to be painting on a door that's going to be lit if we overcast the street. So even Tracy showing up in, like, this yellow room where his coat is blending into the background of this just feels so dynamic, so vibrant, and so comic book-like that these different shots and quick cuts, and we're seeing people in red and yellows against their contrast or maybe a syncopated primary color. It just feels so nice. Like all the pops of color, like, feel so visually bombastic in a way that's draws me in.
It's interesting how they're hitting, like you said, that, like, the visual bombasticness, as you put it, like keeping the color in it while still hitting the noir touch points. So, like, when you have somebody, like, in silhouette talking into a microphone, there's, like, a big, like, just neon wash of color behind them to, like, keep up the, you know, if there's no detail on them, then there's going to be a shitload of color behind them. In the diner scenes, whenever, like, Dick Tracy and his girl and the kid are in the diner, that you have the, like, Venetian blinds on the windows, but every time we're shooting from outside the blinds, they're completely washed, like, solid green with light.
Oh, really?
Like, they're never, like, silhouetted black Venetian blinds. Yeah, it's, like, just a primary green, like, weird. Yeah. Like, it's – so it never quite hits the same dark, like, you know, kind of gritty tone of noir. It, like, keeps up the comic book nature of it all, even while hitting the, like, visual elements of noir, which is, like, a smart way to combine that without sinking into the, like, kind of grittier nature of it. My second shot here is a good example of what I'm talking about, though, where it's, like, it's Pacino and Mandy Patinkin in the car when Pacino's finally, like, giving up and paying him to, you know, take down... Give no face the go ahead to take down Dick Tracy, whatever. You have this, like, very classic noir, like, two guys making a deal in the back of a car while the shadows move around on them. The, like, wash of light, like, going from dark red but then, like, you know, it's giving enough detail on both their faces. The light's coming up slowly on Mandy, and then you're dropping them both back into darkness. Like, we're just kind of, like, riding that wave between these two genres in a way that the shot really exemplifies.
I love that a lot. Like, like you mentioned, the now that I'm not even going to say I didn't notice it, but these washes of color in the back of the rear view of cars are handled in such an interesting way. And I think some of that washing and transitioning that we're making happens, like you just mentioned, in the back of the scene here. But one example that I loved a lot, too, was, like, Charlie looking into the car. Like, we're in the back of Warren Beatty, and I'm forgetting it's Samuel Cassell? Seymour Cassell? I think it's Seymour Cassell. Forget the dude's name. He's been in a ton of shit that I love. But the dude is always wearing orange in the...
Detectives or whatever.
Yeah. And Charlie, like, the back of the wash is, like, green. And, like, but Charlie has this red. Obviously, his color motif is red. He's, like, looking in, but there's... So he's hitting it with 1K? What do you think? What do you think? Is that a jail over 1K? We're just blasting.
Oh, it's like a 10K for sure. 10K,
yeah. So there's, like, you still get that little bit of that, like, where the light is, like, falling off the kid, like, the reds, but it's kind of, like, blending with in the back of the mirror. I don't know if you kind of, but it was just a cool technique, that wash of color being, if a character's in the moment of that wash of color as the car is driving, it's just an interesting use of that red, green wash of color back there with Charlie. I like a lot of that. Please cut all of that.
No, because I get what you said. Like, because it's the same thing I was kind of talking about with the Venetian blinds, where it's like they're instead of doing like the black and white deep luminance contrast, they're doing like primary color, opposite end color theory contrast. So it's like, it's weird where it, you don't have like the deep kind of like loss of detail in your blacks that you would have in a noir, where it's that kind of like reverse film stock look. This is getting really into the nitty gritty of it, but the getting still like contrast out of colors by having things, pulling things into pure green and pure red. So you're able to have like distinct comic booky shapes without getting like white and black, like noir. It's like finding, committing to that color saturation is so smart to still get the blockiness that you need to hit those comic book looks. Like, just a really interesting solution to a problem that they created for themselves.
Yeah, nice. Studio now, Everpress Play. These are gonna be your next ones, my bad.
Yeah. Do you have any studio notes? I mean, that's our optional, right?
Just gotta recast Warren Beatty. I think that's the you gotta get somebody that, because I feel like what he's doing is we're just going straight square draw, do-gooder kind of thing.
Yeah,
but I need a little bit more. I need somebody that has a little bit more of a playful uncle thing with the kid. There's a bit of that there, but the chemistry is never anything to write home about. Like they just seem like they're. I need a little bit more, and I'm trying to think like Robin was always really good at that. You brought up Jumanji.
Yeah, but it's got they like got to be square jawed too, right?
Right, but I need that spark. I need a little bit more child, adult actor spark. And what are some roles that spring to mind that I'm Jungle to Jungle, Tim Allen?
I was thinking like Bruce Willis maybe, but I don't think he doesn't come across as like a 30s, 40s era guy.
Arnold kind of had it with Edward Young or Edward Furlong a little bit.
Yeah, but I don't think you'd have an Austrian detective.
No. But I'm trying to get a more role. Like Sigourney had it with her kid in Aliens. I'm trying to think more there's more performances where there's a bit of a spark. Yeah. Older actor, seasoned actor.
I like this weird through line in our noir movies for some reason are all about like having kids between Thief, this movie, and Yee Yee next week are all we have three noir movies that we picked without telling each other.
Yeah, you're thinking, this year's noir. Yeah, noir movie.
All three of our picks this month are like dealing with fatherhood as a noir, which is a very strange coincidence for three dudes that don't have kids that pick these movies.
That's fucking amazing. I would absolutely, I have pressed play on this. I've watched it twice this week. I absolutely love this movie. I mean, even despite some of my Warren Beatty criticism, there's things that I feel like he obviously, he's Warren Beatty. You're going to a base level of police.
I was going to say, what was the point? Because you texted me on your first watch, 10 minutes. It had to have been like less than a half an hour after we talked. What was the point where you were like, in? Like, I'm texting Sean, I'm in.
The Breathless Mahoney scene. I like it that it was a little cheeky. You know, it was a little tantalizing. I was like, oh, Sean, I didn't know we were going to get that in Dick Tracy. Like, it's just a straight-up comic book movie. All of it, like I was in with the card table. Okay? Yeah, and I love the noir aesthetic. Seeing this little face dude, but with his
little face is so perfect. He's my favorite. Face is my favorite because it's the moment where you're like, he turns around and you're like, I know that guy's name. That guy's name's Little Face. He's got a little face, and now he's dead. This movie rips.
Yeah. What part do you think you were out on as a kid? Like, do you remember like how far you got into the movie? You're like, oh no, I'm not watching this anymore. I don't like this.
That's a good question. I think. Probably pretty immediately, Because I think lips is gross. Lips definitely sets the tone early of you're like, oh, this sucks. And like, that's the intention, right? Like, it's like Madonna's like disgusted with watching him eat, which that she tells him that as much, which is very funny. But then some of the other, I'm trying to remember the other guys. Like, I think one of the least successful makeup effects for me is like Graveface or whatever his fucking name is.
Bruneface?
Is that, I don't like him in the light. Mm. Like, there's a couple shots of his where it just doesn't work for me. Like, he just looks, it's a little too. I think you can see
the separation of the eye, like in the eye cavity area.
It's built up. It
feels a little in it. But I'm not going to be like, I love the shot too, where I would never be caught dead in a place that had one, because he looks dead too, because he obviously doesn't look like an honest citizen. Just like how he's being styled. So the whole moment of it is just funny. So there's bits of it that I even love me some Bruneface.
Well, I can't argue. I'm glad that you like this one though. This is
an awesome noir pick. I've been wanting to. I mean, like I said, I've seen stills of this. I've seen the Al Pacino makeup in the past. It never really. I don't know why. I don't know. I thought it was a lesser than movie. I thought it was like sort of a Roger Rabbit ripoff when I was a kid. It just never really felt like the right time when you got an adult. Like, what would you put on Dick Tracy and for what reason?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not like I have pressed play on this recently, so I can't blame you. But that's what the pod's for, baby, is right and wrongs. Yeah.
So let's talk about some more rights and less wrongs coming up in our next pick after this. All right, McGee, coming up next week, we got a special guest, Max, back on the pod. So happy about this.
Taking the throne. Had to come back for his third appearance.
Yeah. Is he leading? He's leading the appearances, huh? Third? Three?
This will be his third. Yeah. So far, because him and Andy have both had two. So
it's always.
He had to come back, claim his throne. Solid. Always a solid choice, especially for Noirvember. And he's bringing us
yee-yee.
I mean, he yee-yee-ass movies. 2000s yee-yee translates a one and a two.
A one and a two and a here's the log line.
I was giving you the backing while you were going to do the log line. Like, a one and a two and a
log line. A middle-class family in Taipei over the course of 1 year, beginning with a wedding and ending with a funeral. That's the movie. It is a Taiwanese drama, melodrama, a long one, a 3-hour film, and it's available.
It's a long one. I mean, you can break it in chunks. Watch it like a mini series if you have to. But you know, definitely if you want to commit. It's streaming on Criterion. Streaming
on the Criterion channel right now. It is and the entire collection is up there, meaning.
Why did I say Criterion like it was a Transformer?
Criterion, roll out.
Criterion!
And it's the entire collection is up there, including all the supplemental materials.
It's the bus. It's the bus with all the DVDs, is the Transformer, and shoots little discs.
It's the Criterion bus?
Criterion!
Roll
Eat my discs!
That's amazing. But I am going to say, so every time.
This is the gold we hide at the end of the episodes. This
it's completely just falling apart. Dawson's Breeze just left us minutes ago. Every time Max comes on the pod, he really does like shake some shit up, and I cannot wait to talk about my experience watching this movie as I'm trying to contend with Max's reputation in this film. So it's gonna be some very exciting.
He's just like waiting, just like, oh no, the longer it goes without anything horrific happening, it's just the longer the rubber band is stretching in the tension of just like, Things are going to get really nasty here in a second, aren't they?
So Grace, looking forward to breaking down this coming up. So that's Yi Yi, 2000's Yi Yi, written and directed by Edward Yang, available right now on the Criterion Channel. Excellent, excellent masterpiece, modern classic, and we're going to have a great time breaking that out. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Next week.
Yi Yi! Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.